welcome back to the second series of Legal Cheek's Legal History Podcast. I'm Alex Aldridge, the publisher of Legal Cheek, and with me is Alan Paul, one of the most well-known corporate lawyers of his generation. And today we're going to be talking about the period from 1993 until 2008. In the previous edition of the podcast, we looked at 1978 till 1993, so a real focus on the 80s. So if you haven't listened to that edition already, do check it out. Really interesting episode. But you don't need to have listened to that to listen to this podcast. This is a standalone episode focusing on the 90s and the noughties through up to the financial crisis in 2008. So welcome back, Alan.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a delight to be talking about this again. And of course, having done the 80s, which was law firms growing, lots of change, you're now into a different period, which is a bit of a roller coaster when things were transformed. And if I was to think of two words which describe the period, it's globalization, both generally and for law firms, and systemic risk, which culminated, as we know.
Okay, and that's, we're going to actually jump ahead to 2008, the end of this period, before we explore from 93, because it was really quite a dramatic end. And what are your recollections from that period, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, just before saying that, I think it's very important to remember that we're talking about a very different era to today.
Yeah.
And just to, you know, London was still the top, you know, international finance centre.
It still is, lots though, of isn't things. It,
and it still is, yeah, for international debt, for, yeah, insurance, Forex, and it's the second biggest asset management place in the world.
Yeah.
So, and lawyers grown and grown. But the big companies then were people like oil companies, financial companies, okay, GE, industrial companies, not tech.
So the big tech companies didn't exist, of course.
No.
I suppose some did. Microsoft, Apple, they did.
Yeah, they had started, but they hadn't become massive. Like, and you know, I think Amazon had probably floated by the IPO and so on. So, but the biggest companies were obviously in the more substantial industrial type of business or financial services. So that's a different time. And then by the time we got to 2008, there'd been a splurge, if you like, of this systemic debt issuance of all sorts, and we'll come to the detail of that. And if I were to say there were three things which mark out how they got to 2008, which was when the dominoes all fell over or the dam broke, it is securitizations, and we can talk about very briefly what those are.
Yeah.
Derivatives and commercial banks doing investment banking again.
Okay.
Those are the big three things which I think probably caused ultimately the bubble to burst.
Okay.
And we can do a bit more detail on that. Yeah. So that's where we ended up. But derivatives and securitizations, these, yep, things, they're not dirty words. They're all, yep, proper things. It's only when they go wrong, and people get, if you like, too enthusiastic about them, that things can go wrong.
And these were new financial innovations that were essentially invented, in terms of securitizations and derivatives, invented during that period, and they grew.
In the form that they took, yes. I mean, okay, they're actually quite an old idea, okay, in many ways, but yes. And do you want me to talk about the, what they are exactly?
Or? Yeah, I think it's a good time. Okay, to quick definitions. Yeah,
bit simply, the, yeah, you can, if I'm a bank and you're a borrower to buy a house, and this has its roots in mortgage lending, for people to buy houses in the US. You want to buy a house, I lend you money, take a mortgage, but I'm a bank, I can't sell that to anybody. I've got to keep it on my balance sheet. However, I've got 10,000 of you. I can put them all in a box, what they call a special vehicle company. I can put them all in a box, and I can sell bonds in that box to investors around the world, mm-hmm, because underlying it is quite a lot of interest payments and, if they are prime mortgages, good credits. And so suddenly this is off my balance sheet, and then I can then lend more money to do more mortgages. That's fundamentally what a securitization involved.
Sure.
But anybody who then buys a bond buys a bit of insurance.
Yeah.
In case things go wrong, and that's when you get into the securitization instruments are called, you know, mortgage-backed securities, if you like, collateral debt obligations. And then there's a thing called a credit default swap, which is just a piece of insurance if the underlying thing goes wrong. And you get to pay a fee, like a premium, and you get somebody, like a bank, to say, I'll see you good if that goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, of course, all these investors have credit default swaps, and we are talking trillions and trillions. So that's what they fundamentally are, but there was so much of it by 2008. And derivatives, well, those are things which, again, a bit like insurance, or it's a way of placing a bet on an asset without actually buying it.
So essentially, these were kind of exotic financial debt-related products, and there was problems with them, and there were things like bad mortgages in those, subprime mortgages. And the period sort of from 1993 to 2008, these products had kind of become used more and more in a more extreme way, and it culminated in 2008 with this big crash where it all went wrong.
Yeah, and I think what we have to remember is that these securitizations and these other complex products were being done through a sort of what some people called a shadow banking system, whereas retail banks, which is consumers and commercial banks, they're highly regulated, whereas investment banks, hedge funds and so on, weren't. And I saw that by 2008, in the US alone, there was $10 trillion of securitizations out of a total credit market of $25 trillion. That's the US alone.
Okay, so unimaginable amounts.
Yeah, and Europe was about three quarters of that amount. So you can see there's a hell of a lot of things that once they start to go wrong and the dominoes fall over, everybody's trying to get out.
Yeah. And how had it got to this position? Is it that the regulators are asleep at the wheel?
Well, I'm not going to lay blame. Mm. I think it's probably a combination of stuff. It will include the regulators.
Yeah.
It will include important people in this, accreditors. You know, the credit rating agencies, because they say whether these are, you know, triple A's or triple B's or whatever.
Yeah.
And arguably they overrated a lot of the bonds, mm-hmm. the mortgage-backed securities. And there's the regulator. And, of course, then there's the everybody who's investing.
Sure.
Not really spotting what's going on. So that might be risk management within financial houses. I'm not going to cast blame, but those are the three.
So a kind of broad, widespread mania in some ways that led to it. But there's a good film, The Big Short, which probably many of the listeners have heard, which covers this period. So that's 2008. And let's jump back to the beginning of the period. So our last podcast ended in kind of 92, 93. And that's where we're going to pick up. And it really didn't look like this was the beginning of this kind of crazy era of debt. I mean, there was a recession. Thatcher, her reign, which started at the beginning of the previous podcast in the late 70s, was coming to an end. Interest rates were extremely high. I mean, 14%, which people are saying that they're high at the moment, kind of 4.25% and 4.5%, but, you know, really high interest rates. And the UK wasn't in a great place. It had been forced to withdraw from the exchange rate mechanism. So, I mean, you know, still very different from the late 70s, where we'd began the last episode. I mean, the world had come a long way, the City of London had come a long way, but not a great time, a real recession. I mean, what was it like back then, sort of 93, 94?
Yeah, once we got to, things started to really pick up in 93, but obviously the period of 90 to 92, not too much was happening for people like me. I couldn't incorporate corporate finance. It was a difficult time. What was happening, which is great, always good for lawyers, bad times, was a lot of people were not doing very well, and you had the reconstructions going on, which I think we touched on last time. And of course in 93 Canary Wharf went bust, as did other people. And then if these were, you know, in receivership or in insolvency proceedings, there was for years, those lasted for years.
Okay.
Reconstruction. So that sort of work took off through this period. And then after 93, everything started to get back. And on it went, and it then went pretty well.
So as a lawyer in that period, partner at Allen Overy, you've been kind of kept busy on those kind of restructurings?
I think it's not work I would ideally have done, but everybody who... You needed so many bodies, really, to get involved in these things. You tried to turn your hand to help in that, even though what you wanted to do might have been deals, as it were.
It's quite a time, and you're just kind of doing what you can.
They needed more bodies able to do these reconstructions. So you had got involved in it, but it wasn't the main work that you hoped to do. Yeah.
And then how did things start to build from there?
Okay, well... obviously, in this period, what grew in the 90s, after things settled down and interest rates came back to 5 to 7%, whatever they were in the later 90s, it grew, three things grew, I think. The M&A grew, private equity came in a big way, a thing we haven't talked much about, probably won't, but things like project finance grew, different stuff. And, of course, we've said... securitizations and the bond issuance market started to take over from what I call the standard bank credit facility market. They still both existed, but the bonds grew and grew. And that was, again, a lot of legal work.
So this presumably is a development of the kind of things like we talked about in the last podcast, leverage buyouts. So that was a kind of theme of the 80s. And so was this kind of an evolution of those kind of debt-funded deals?
Yeah, I think this time now, and as you went into the 2000s, but in the 90s, was when, as I think we said last time, the management buyout was the typical thing. And then by 1990, private equity was starting to buy businesses, not necessarily with the assistance of the management of those businesses. But then... after 93, what happened was we were now seeing big funds growing in Europe. And by the end of the 90s, you'll find that big names like CVC, I don't know if you're familiar with these names, Cinven, Permira, people like
private
that.
Private equity houses.
All private equity houses. Yeah. These had grown. They were now, instead of, with smaller funds, I mean, interestingly, take Cinven, that originated in the 90s from the British Coal Pension Funds.
Right.
But then it changed its spots and raised its own funds and turned into a very big private equity house, as did Permira, came out of Schroders, as Schroder Ventures. But then in the 90s, it grew and it started raising funds in their billions.
Yeah.
By 2000 and so on.
Okay.
So, and you had the Americans coming in, KKR, people like that, and Blackstone grew and others, Texas Pacific and so on. And all these people now competing for deals. So instead of just MBOs, you had what we call management buy-ins, where they didn't hire the management. You had buy and build, which is where they'd buy one business and another. And public to privates became quite popular. That's taking public companies private.
And London seems to be a kind of magnet for a lot of this work internationally.
Yeah, I think... a lot of this, London learns a lot always from the US techniques and that sort of stuff. So private equity had been big in the US, and a natural place everybody to come would be London. And then you find after London, the Asia grew too.
Yeah.
But I can't really speak knowledgeably about that.
Yeah.
So London was their European hubs for all these people.
Okay.
And now, of course, they're probably spread all over Europe, but that's...
That's how it started. So that American influence was important.
Yeah, and with those American private equity funds came American law firms.
Who expanded quite a lot in that period.
They came with their favourite clients,
And so just if you kind of look at the wider developments taking place at that time, so you had Tony Blair's New Labour government came into power in 1997. You had the handover of Hong Kong back to China in also 1997. And then you had the Good Friday Agreement in 1998.
Yeah.
I mean, these are like really significant kind of political developments. Were they important to the kind of the work you were doing at the time and the economy?
I mean, all the events like that, that are relevant. I mean, the main thing I think probably people in London felt from things like the Good Friday Agreement was we were no longer going to be bombed by IRA.
IRA, which we talked about in the last episode.
We did.
Bombs in the city of
London. Yes. Indeed, my wife was experienced one from the IRA in the London Stock Exchange.
Narrowly avoided.
Yes, she did. Well, it's an interesting moral, which I'll tell you at the end. She got to work in the morning in her car, went up in a small lift from the car park to the main lifts and then up to her office.
Yeah.
And 10 minutes in the office and the alarms went off, bomb, bomb, bomb. She was pregnant at the time with her first son and she had to walk down 20 flights of stairs.
Yeah.
Which wasn't great. Got to the bottom, got out and, you know, queued up with the normal emergency things. A few minutes later, the bomb went off. And where it was in that little lift which she had gone up from the car park into.
Wow, so she'd been in the lift where the bomb
had been planted in. Yeah, that left shaft is where the bomb went. The moral, of course, is don't be late for work.
So, wow. But that's the kind of thing you were kind of having to live with in the 80s. I mean, really quite terrifying stuff like that. So the fact that there was kind of peace in Northern Ireland, I suppose you had this kind of business-friendly centre-left government, the economy was ticking over nicely, interest rates were coming down, and, you know, people felt good, there was this optimism. I mean, and in globally, you saw that with, I mean, the Hong Kong handover, and that was a time when, you know, there was a lot of international companies doing bit or seeking to grow in China, and
yes.
quite a contrast to now, really, where the world is kind of... It seems a lot more kind of gloomier and pessimistic. That must have been a real time of optimism.
Yeah, it was, which and I think everybody, China, of course, was growing year on year, I think probably 10% a year, was becoming a real, real force, as we all know. And, of course, the law firms at this time were really expanding.
Yeah.
You know, for the Clifford Chance, Alan Overy, Clifford Chance expanded hugely in that period, as did others. I think Linklaters opened in Shanghai in the 90s. Alliances were being formed. So I think with Hong Kong, I think, and China, everybody saw those things as big opportunities. And Asia was, of course, by now, people were opening their offices, had become a big land of opportunity. With China, the big player. And, of course, how well people did, I'm sure, varies quite a lot. But as we all know, they've all had to pull in their horns in China since. So, for a long time though, it was an important area of expansion.
And I suppose it was part of this kind of wider international expansion. We saw big law firms during that period, where, like many of their clients, they grew, and they were serving new markets, and. You had kind of slightly, I suppose, different kinds of organisations as they grew than the kind of... I mean, in the 80s, sure, they were growing already, but they were becoming something different. These much more kind of professional, profit and revenue-focused organisations with more competition.
Well, should I...
Yeah.
I can expand a bit on that. I think it's important to... because what's going to have happened by 2008, I think... is that law firms really had been had transformed from what they were 20 years before in the city we're talking about. And it's how that, you know, how law firms work, how they commercially make money, that sort of thing. And I'm sure your audience will know very well that a typical law firm, certainly then, maybe a bit more sophisticated now, basically, it was hours worked by legal bodies, you know, the human beings. So you multiply the hours by the number of people, and that gave you a revenue. And once you hit a certain amount, everything else was profit. And you'll know, too, that law firms, because they were partnerships, or much the same structure then, distribute every year all their profits. So they don't sort of invest like corporates do. They hold a load of money back and they dividend out everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different commercial model to corporates. So they're incentivized, really, partners to try every year to make as much money as they possibly can because they're sharing in that pool.
Mm. But then there's a kind of lack of investment, perhaps.
Well, arguably there is, and that's I think that's partly why the bigger the firms became, the more they were able to invest because you could do that year on year, and partners didn't mind. But if you're relatively small, that was very difficult to do because it really took the income from the partner. So the bigger firms got, the more they could invest, and therefore the bigger firms got, the bigger they got. Mm. And the smaller firms, as we'll see later, quite a few had to merge with other people and so on.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that's perhaps worth, and tell me, I mean, because this was an expansion abroad, from the UK for a lot of firms, is how you do that. There are really basically three ways. One, you merge with a firm, and we'll see one or two of those later.
Yeah.
And that gives you a business, but it also gives you a lot of stuff you probably don't want.
Yeah.
So then you've got to reorganize. Or you hire one or two partners and you grow it organically like that, hiring here and there. But you don't. That doesn't bring a business.
Yeah.
So you've got to fund it. And or you buy groups of partners who will come with some business and then you add on and add on. So the challenges are if you buy an existing firm, it comes with its own culture and people who are wedded to each other.
Yeah. You
build partners from outside. Well, they're not wedded to each other. They're not wedded to anybody. But you have to integrate each one.
Yeah.
And create like a culture. So it's a huge, and it can be a very expensive process.
Yeah.
So that was, those two things were quite important to the background of how law firms developed in that time and later on.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the kind of focus on revenues and profits and the kind of cultural change around that?
Yeah. It meant that the law firms became much more performance-oriented organisations where each year, some firms would have done it differently, etc. But fundamentally, most firms would have started having, if they didn't for associates before, they would certainly be having annual reviews for associates, you know, and that sort of thing. But also for all the partners.
Yeah.
And of course, that meant that, as we talked last time, I think management need to be able to measure stuff, so revenue and profit per partner, per group of partners, per office, became highly relevant measurement numbers, which they weren't before.
Mm.
And that therefore changes, if you like, the pressures on partners who become very focused on, well, I've got to make the revenue, so how do you do that? Well, I explained, you know, it's bodies.
Yeah.
And what sort of work have you got? And have you got the right clients to do the profitable work? So you start to get a potential competition in firms.
Yeah.
Now that changes the culture. And there's no doubt that target were inevitable. Targets became the focal point probably for a lot of people and still are making your targets. And I think that changes the partnership dynamic in a major way. And the challenge for law firms has always been, and I think remains, how you keep a collegiate, and lawyers love the word collegiate, collegiate cultures, and that's where people work together rather than for themselves. And it's finding there's a delicate balance, which is why relationships between partners and all lawyers in the firm and the support staff are really, really important.
But you can see the tensions there as partners start to think about, you know, really focusing on profits and how they're spending their time. And so maybe, say, an area like learning and development, that rather than spending time kind of training junior lawyers, they think, well, that's a time where I could be billing. And so they start to look at kind of outsourcing arrangements, things like that, which I suppose is more efficient, but it could be costly in terms of firm culture.
I think that's, it's a good point because it definitely was the case, it's a long time ago now, certainly when I was younger and so on, that lawyers really learnt on the job and they learnt from seeing how more senior lawyers operated, and you learnt from their mistakes as well as their merits. And by spending time with them in taxes, by meetings and all that sort of stuff, But now what happened was, of course, you needed to train. Because of the leverage model, you had a lot more lawyers. You needed to make sure they were all trained consistently. You couldn't just rely on that other thing of the personal. So firms had invented these courses. If you were in the financial sector, you had a course on banking, and corporates had courses on corporate and then soft skills and so on. So training became much more formal, and you had to introduce from outside lots of people.
Yeah, and I guess that's just part of the journey of becoming a much bigger organization in a more competitive market. And and then the other thing relating to that is law firm marketing, which we touched on a bit in the 80s. There's some sort of magazines and stuff, but this really kind of went into overdrive, didn't it, in the 90s?
Yes, the competitiveness for work grew and grew, and I think partly because in the city particularly again, big financial institutions like banks, so they would have panels of lawyers, and every 2 years or whatever you might have to apply for the panel, and you had to spread your credentials and so on. And therefore they were the procurement processes, which were used for, if you like, buying kit, were now being applied to buying legal services.
Okay.
And so I can remember one or two where we were definitely pitched against another firm, and quite simply, we would be told, well, so-and-so is offering this price, can you match it? And that's where now you've got a real competitive tension. And then there's more active marketing with beauty parades where you'd visit people. I can play stories, I can tell you about it. Can I bore you with two?
Yeah.
I bore you with two. We were beauty parading there's a lot of M&A in the 90s.
Yeah.
And one bit of M&A was all those privatized companies, this is a wonderful thing, the electricity distribution companies privatized in the 80s, everybody did very, very well, sold out of government. And then they started to be bought in the 90s. They were all bought by foreign and non-UK companies like American power companies and French power companies and German power companies. And for each of those deals was a public deal. We beauty paraded for one. Because it was an American firm, we beauty paraded over video, which is quite a new thing
at that time.
And we went in, sat down, and we had this interview, and we just talked and what have you. And then as we went out, we saw another Magic Circle firm, their team, who we all knew, coming in to do their video and that sort of thing.
Oh, so it was in a kind of video room?
Yeah, a video room in a hotel or something.
Okay, yeah.
Can't remember exactly. And they then went up, you know, this is a typical beauty parade. They went up and did their bit.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to say we won the job.
Yeah.
And when I asked the chap why we won the job, he said, well, compared to the other lot, you took your jackets off, rolled up your sleeves, and that was how you appeared, whereas they sat in their suits and ties. And he said, well, that's the difference between the two of you, and nothing else.
Wow.
Quite straightforward.
Wow. So was that kind of Americans didn't mind kind of more in a more
well,
informal
he's just that
kind
person.
Of approach? And yeah,
just yeah, it was, that person. So you never
lucky.
Know.
You got
had
lucky.
No idea what he was like.
Someone else would choose the other way.
I think luck is the right word. Yeah. Another one was we used to go we did in the UK, but I would go off to the US to actually see companies we'd never met.
Mm.
And I remember going on one of these trips, where we'd go for a week. And there was one I wrote to and said, they're quite a big US company, so we don't know who you are. Can we come and see you, just tell you who we are and find out what you would do? And they never replied. And we went off and did our trip, and we probably got a bit of work out of it from various others. And then a week later, I got back, and I saw this company that never replied was rumoured in the paper to be looking at an acquisition. So we sent off an email straight away. Mm. Said, oh, you're looking at this. You want to watch so-and-so and so-and-so. These things could trip you up.
Okay.
Got an email back. Oh, well, we better talk to you. And so the ones we never saw, we got this lovely job from.
Okay.
And then they were clients for about another 5 years. So
wow.
All the other marketing we'd done, we'd go face-to-face, well, we got a bit of work. But this one, we got huge amounts of work. So it was all a bit random.
Okay. So it's just some of those trips could maybe just be an excuse for a nice holiday.
It's outrageous.
But stuff came. I suppose you had to be in the mix, getting yourself out there.
And that's what people were doing.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not just the Magic Circle at this time that were growing. You had a lot of other interesting stories of law firm growth. I mean, Eversheds was interesting. That was lots of smaller firms that did this kind of multiple mergers.
Yeah.
And then you had DLA Piper, which kind of went from being
almost a high street firm in Sheffield to being the biggest law firm in the world, albeit via a kind of different ownership structure, which was kind of cheated a bit.
Yeah, I mean, they did amazing, because I think in the 90s, they were just still, they merged various firms, Leeds, Sheffield, wherever it was, Diblupton, all sorts. And then before you knew it, by 2005, they were in London, merging with two American firms to create DLA Piper, which is a remarkable story.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, they became a big law firm.
And that seems to be sort of emblematic of the kind of anything's possible atmosphere of this time of kind of growth and optimism. And you had lots of good individual lawyer stories too of lawyers moving. There was a lot more movement than there was, you know, like in the 80s or before that.
Oh, yeah.
But individual lawyers moving to different firms and kind of scaling the heights from relatively lowly positions.
Yeah, that was certainly possible. There was much more movement by the 2000s. There was a lot more movement of partners. It hadn't gathered the hugest pace, but every law firm that did commercial work, even if they weren't the top, they all had good partners in them.
Yeah.
And I think what did tend to happen is some of the best partners in some of these smaller firms realized they could upgrade, and because firms became open to lateral hiring and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there became this mobility. And yes, if you were a very good lawyer in a smaller firm, you could come to join a London firm and then move up, which was a very different change to what was happening before.
Which is kind of almost taken for granted now, but just absolutely wasn't the done thing before.
No, but that grew and grew. And I think, interestingly, of course, the US firms.
Yeah.
I don't know if we could just mention. Yeah, no,
absolutely. Yeah, because you said they followed the private equity houses across and they were growing.
Yeah, and whilst they started in the 90s to do UK law, which before that they weren't really doing much. And of course, the English firms were starting to do US law in the 90s, 2000. But I think Scadden, for example, appointed its first UK partner doing UK law in 94.
Yeah.
While Gottschall opened in 95 or 96, and other firms were coming, and they were going to do English law, which meant, of course, partners in due course could move from English firms.
Were you ever tempted to move to a US firm?
Yes, I was at one point, but won't name it. But it was an interesting idea, and whilst one might have made more money at that particular time. You know, I mean, you know, the thing is, as a partner, certainly for me, if you're not one of the greatest lawyers, which I definitely wasn't, you need a lot of support. It's about teams and to be successful. And A&O had that. You had teams and you had the support services. Everything was there. Whereas at this point in the US firm's life span, they were growing, but they were only 20 people or 30 people. So they didn't have this support and team. So you knew your life would be different. Let's put it that way.
Right. Interesting.
So I didn't know.
And then the final point on this segment before we jump ahead to the kind of turn of the decade .com crash is the growth of in-house lawyering. We started in the 80s, companies hiring their own in-house lawyers, and these teams really began to grow, particularly the banks hiring a lot of lawyers.
They did. And it's things like, of course, you had in 95, like you had that wonderful House of Barings, a well-known investment bank, merchant bank.
Yeah.
So it went bust because of rogue trading, they called it, in Asia.
Of course, yeah. Nick Leeson.
Yeah. And that I think, opened some eyes to how, I'm not saying what went wrong in Barings, so that's too more complex, but that we can't have these sorts of things happening. You have to control it. There was obviously some form of lack of control there.
Yeah.
And of course that built up then for the compliance, the legal functions, I think from times like that, people realised, they've got to be given more weight, be listened to more, compliance, etc., etc. So those grew. Yeah, and therefore new career paths were opening up for
And
that was young lawyers in other firms, yeah.
And so working at, say, in-house, it's going to typically, you don't earn as much money as a partner in a big law firm, but you still earn very well, and you've got kind of more manageable hours, and you're kind of more of a business person focusing on the kind of aims of the kind of half business person, half lawyer almost.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't work in-house, but yeah, you've got to get involved in the businesses probably. I mean, much more than obviously any private practice lawyer can, except, as you know, that this was another way for actually people to get interested in going in-house. This was the period when secondment started to come in.
Right.
In quite a big way for the law firms. The banks would demand, particularly banks and other clients, big clients, you know, who had big legal departments, say, well, if we're going to give you our work, we want secondments. Well, next question, what will you pay for them? No, don't want to pay for them. And so,
free labour.
Yeah, opportunities came up for bright people, because only bright people tend to go, to go in-house, work for a year or 6 months, whatever it was, 2 years.
Okay.
And of course realise, well, there is another way of doing things.
Right.
Quite a few, I think, who had that experience took it up later in life. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then, so things are going great, economy's booming, everyone's in a good mood, and then you hit the turn of the decade and there's the things start to go. I mean, there's the dot-com crash, there's 9/11, there's the Enron collapse. I suppose in the run-up to that, there was a kind of strange millennium bug incident where there was all this collective fear. And so, but maybe that's kind of symptomatic of just a time when things have been going great and suddenly the fear comes in towards the end of the decade and there's this downturn.
Yeah, there were glitches then because, but the dot-com, these were the, you know, new tech companies, which this may sound familiar, new tech companies which weren't making any revenues and weren't making any profits, were being valued at ludicrous sums, and some were IPO'd, and this bubble grew and grew, there was a bubble, and which burst effectively in 2001 or two, I can't remember exactly. But that was a really weird time.
Yeah.
And lots of law firms wanted to get involved in this stuff. But you had to really invest in it, and you had to invest time. Hard to make for law firms to make a lot of money out of it. But that was an interesting phenomenon. It didn't cause a crash or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it was there was a lot of M&A going on. We can maybe touch on that at some point.
Yeah.
But there was also, and then we had 9/11, of course. That was 2001, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But in 2000, you had things like Clifford Chance merging with Rogers and Wells.
Okay. So I suppose tech wasn't as central to the economy as it is now. So
no.
The dot-com crash didn't have the kind of same wider effect.
No, it was definitely a significant blip, but I don't know, it didn't in my view, right here.
And around that time, was things like kind of law firms taking equity in these new startups instead of fees and things like that? And
yeah, some people did that.
So I guess some must have lost out pretty badly.
Well, but some may have made some money. You never know. Yeah. There were successes. I mean, don't forget, there were successes. It was pretty common in the US on the West Coast. Firms, I think, they actually incubated, you know, these venture companies, early stages. And you only need a few to go well to make, to do very well. So I imagine if you had, you went in early and took some equity in Google before it took off, you probably could retire fairly soon after that.
So when you say incubated them, were they kind of providing legal services for free and in return they were getting, was the way with the model. Yeah.
But they had ways of doing it. You have to, if you're going to do that, you need to have a package.
Yeah.
Which you've already got, which you don't have to keep, you know, individualizing too much to people because that's when it gets difficult. You just, once you've got the package, you can sell it. Yeah,
I suppose you had your Google and Amazon's. Well, Amazon did IPO around then, certainly.
Yeah,
and fell and then came back and but then you had a lot of stuff which was really flimsy with just like a web address and an idea. And it does sound like there's...
There was some of that, but it wasn't that big over here. There was some, but it wasn't... There's probably some people will have done more of it than others, but it wasn't ever big for people okay. over here. I don't think, but not for the big firms.
But here you had kind of in the run up to that, you had the Millennium Bug. So that yes. seems that created plenty of work for firms. And what was that?
Well, it was just there was this fear because no, it was the unknown that we were suddenly we're going to move from everything beginning with 19 to everything beginning with 20 mm. in the day, and that all the electronic computer systems would all blow up. And so from a lawyer's point of view, oh dear, this, how are we going to deal with this? Well, there's only one way to deal with it, is create contractual provisions. So you suddenly saw, oh, argument and efforts about how are we going to protect ourselves against the Millennium Bug. So contracts, financial agreements, all sorts. Suddenly saw these clauses about what happens if the world blows up. And of course, almost nothing happened.
But
lawyers, it was very exciting at the time.
That must have, I mean, that's a good example of kind of lawyers being able to ride the various developments and do well regardless.
Yeah. It's a small, you know, it didn't last long, but
I remember the fear of that and what would happen, and it, yeah, nothing happened. But maybe that was because everyone was so well prepared.
yes, that may be it.
And then you had, I mean, 9/11, and that was obviously the planes going into the World Trade Center and thousands of people killed in the US. You know, shocking moment. People, what happened then?
I think what happened, apart from the shock and the people, you know, trying to get over it, I think people went on hold a bit, you know, obviously. Tourism and air travel, I suppose insurance, probably the sectors which took the biggest hit directly.
Yeah.
But I think we all froze a little bit, saying, well, the world's gone mad. Mm. Whatever next? What could happen? So it took a while for that to settle down again, but it didn't cause a recession or anything like that.
Right.
And it got handled. I think the Americans were pretty amazing about it in many ways, how they came back. Mm. I mean, you think, okay, I think it was Lehman, for example, lost huge numbers of people in those towers, but came back, you know. And I think you have to admire what they did in the light of that. Okay, you may not admire the wars they went to afterwards. That's a different political thing. But the way that the resilience, I thought, was pretty amazing, to be honest. Yeah.
And also around this time, you had the collapse of Enron. That was a big deal.
I think this was... This was a real shock. Enron was a sort of bit of a darling company, and Enron's a energy company in Texas, based in Houston, and they were also an energy trading company, utility and trading, and they traded energy, okay, and they traded in Europe and in the US. But what happened was a reckless use of derivatives.
Okay,
and
so an early
they
sign.
Wrote these derivatives, energy derivatives, but they didn't write them with independent people. They wrote them with their own special purpose vehicle. So the risk that a derivative was supposed to take away was kept in-house in the company, and basically an accounting fraud to create inflate revenue.
Which, okay.
And they went, I think, in the mid-2001, a share price of $90 to 26 cents. For a few months later.
Wow.
And when this was discovered, and the regulators, credit raters, banks, everybody had been dealing with them, had they not seen this? You really did wonder. But again, the SEC went crazy, and it led to a thing called Sarbanes-Oxley in the US, which was much heightened of holding of corporate executives more accountable for financial statements. But even more from a professional services point of view, interest was that one of the big accounting firms at the time, called Arthur Andersen.
That was one of the big five.
Five.
Yeah.
And probably regarded as the most go-ahead, okay. creative and capable and exciting, if you can have that with accountants, exciting accountancy firms.
Okay.
And they, certain of their partners in the US, presumably to help Enron, illegally destroyed documents relevant to the Enron investigation. And Arthur Andersen collapsed within a year. It was a huge company. His partners left, reputation gone. It was an absolute object lesson. As if a professional services company loses its reputation, it's finished. There's no coming back.
And that's just the behaviour of a handful of partners.
I assume it was.
It takes down this mega, you know, like
extraordinary.
PwC now, the same kind of size, which is kind of unthinkable.
But had a knock on also for lawyers.
Because they were building their own firm.
At this time, all the accounting firms were building their law firms. And at this point, I think it had close to 2,500 lawyers in the Arthur Andersen new law firm. That was done. That just disappeared overnight, more or less. And fortunately for all us other law firms, that was one huge competitor, the accountants, blown away for a little while. But of course, they've come back and they're building their own firms now.
They don't seem to be, you know, perhaps as dangerous competitors as some had predicted, though, now, to go on a bit of a tangent.
I suppose if I'm truly honest, I don't really know what work they take away, if you like, from the major firms in the city. I suspect it's not a huge amount. But there will be some work that they do take away. I don't have a handle on how they've got on now.
Okay.
So that's an object lesson anyway.
And then the other kind of development in this turn of the decade period was this kind of touched on a flurry of law firm mergers, particularly kind of UK-US mergers.
Yes. To
create these big transatlantic.
Yeah, firms. There was. I think there were. Maybe that dot-com boom, the 9/11, all sorts of things combined, and maybe some history combined. But I think the smaller, big, but sizable commercial law firms in the city realised they had to get bigger. And the holy grail for most of all of the law firms was, can I merge with the US law firm and create this thing? Because the US is the biggest legal market in the world by far. Create something which spans the world, therefore, because without the US, can you call yourself global? And I think what we saw was smaller firms. I think Roe & Moore that went in 2002, roughly, to Mayer Brown. They merged. But Mayer Brown was a much bigger firm. Reed Smith, I think, with Warner Cranston soon after, and Jones Day with a firm called Gouldens. And there will have been others. And that trend continued, and I think you'll find a lot of the old names from the 80s, who were very significant in the city, did other things, merged with other firms, like Cameron Markby, for example, much later on, merged with McKenna's, and that went on. Norton Rose but this is way beyond
going
our...
Going a bit further. But also around that time, was it Roger and Wells that merged with Clifford Chance?
Yeah, well, that was a very big jolt for the big firms like Eno and everybody else, because here we had... They're merging with a good-sized US firm. And therefore, they would have a US business, which all the major law firms were trying to grow in the US. But by that method of rather than merging, hiring partners or groups of partners, and which was going on. And I don't think any other... the degree of success of Rogers and Wells, I don't know. I wasn't party to it, but it would have had its ups and downs. There would have been partners leaving and so on. But... So that was a big one. And they also merged with a German firm in 1999, actually, Binder. And then Freshfields.
Brookhouse and Derringer
to create this, Brookhouse especially was a massive German firm.
And that was these two German firms. So Freshfields, rather than looking across the Atlantic, looking at Europe and thinking
that time,
to expand that way.
They may have been looking across the Atlantic as well. But that's the one they did, which, again, I think through... The spanner in the works for other firms, because now they became this giant in Europe.
And the A&O partners at that time must surely have been looking around and thinking, well, should we do something?
Well, A&O was growing its international capacity, but it tended to do it. There were mergers, but they were smaller, like in the Netherlands and Belgium. There was the best, very good firms, Love Place, Rebecca. This was done a bit later on. But they tended to do it by groups of partners or single partners.
Okay.
Did it that way in most places at that time, and that was a lot of investment. But it worked. It eventually probably took longer to get a big German presence, but it certainly did.
I suppose
than merging with Brookhouse.
I suppose what I'm getting at is
with that, this kind of time of growth and everything so competitive, there must have been a sense of kind of always looking over your shoulder, looking at the rivals.
Yes, I think we were. I mean, especially when it was a time where we talked about marketing, but also in how people were perceived. And, you know, this was the world of league tables that now become in the 2000s. Everybody wanted to be top of their league tables, and I dare say had ways of classifying their transactions so that they qualified. Various sorts of things went on.
Yeah.
And so it was, yeah, highly competitive. It certainly was.
And that takes us through to the final period in this edition of the podcast, from 2002 through to 2008.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, so you've got the return to growth, the effect of the dot-com crash and 9/11 and Enron kind of fade away. And this is the period when you get the craziest of the debt madness, is I think how you described it.
Yes,
previously
definitely.
When we were discussing this.
Definitely. I mean, it was I think from now to 2008 was boom time. There was several aspects. We talked about private equity, and that really dominated in M&A. But there was also very big corporate global merging was going on from the 90s through now, right in the 2000s. Take, for example, the Mannesmann-Vodafone-Mannesmann merger in 1999-2000. That was the biggest M&A transaction ever. It still is.
Yeah.
I think close to $200 billion.
Well, that's great. So that still is. That's held that record all that time.
I think it still is.
Amazing.
So there's an awful lot of that going on. We had the RBS bought NatWest. NatWest Bank.
That was 99.
That was 99. That happened in 2000.
Okay.
And these, the banks grew exponentially because in 99, the Americans, and this is one of the three factors I mentioned for the 2008 debacle, the Americans repealed Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented commercial banks, the big banks, doing investment banking and trading securities, and they repealed it. And lo and behold, come 2009-10, what were they doing? They were trying to separate investment banking from commercial retail banking, at least within the organization, because they didn't want one tainting the other.
And so Glass-Steagall, my understanding, that was put in place in the 30s, after the 1929
I think
Wall
depressions,
Street
yeah,
crash.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it stayed in place all the way through, and then 99
they got rid of it.
They repealed it, and that was the kind of signal to, okay.
Well, yeah, arguably.
Yeah, so very dangerous.
Well, it meant that systemic possibility of all that, I use that expression, shadow banking of... which went on, which was much less regulated in securitization bonds and all these other bonds and all sorts of debt, could now be, the commercial banks could now be in there.
Mm.
And so there was the mixing of the real banking, as it were.
It's meant to be boring.
but safer with the high risk or higher risk stuff.
And that kind of enabled banks to kind of compete with, like, private equity and...
Well, certainly with the hedge funds doing it and so on. Yeah, private equity was a sort of slightly separate.
Okay.
Separate, but linked, because private equity business generated huge amounts of business for banks and financial houses. Huge amounts, because there was a typical private equity deal. Now you're talking about deals of $1 billion, $2 billion, $5 billion.
Yeah.
Was huge financing. This is not just debt financing, it's bank financing. It was now largely being done through bonds, high yield bonds. And high yield bonds sounds great because it get high yield, but with high yield goes increased risk.
Right.
And different layers of debt appeared. And so that's another market, which, again, relatively unregulated, was all part of the same same thing going
on. And before, you'd never had these kind of different layers of debt to the same extent.
Not the same degree, not in such vast amounts.
And I'm just thinking about kind of how for young people starting their careers at this time, they would have looked at kind of banks and the finance sector is a very exciting area to go into. So it's risky, which itself is probably attractive. And it was kind of, and also it's probably paying the highest salaries. And you've got this kind of challenging new stuff being done, such as around different layers of debt. And I suppose it's like now, probably the industries that many graduates want to join, like big tech companies, that kind of thing. That's kind of leading the economy. But at this time, it were these big unregulated banks.
They were regulated, but they were different type. Okay. But it was the opportunity. But you'll remember, I guess, after 2008, people talked all about bankers' bonuses. Well, there was an opportunity to make a lot more money in the financial sector through deals and so on, and the bonus systems, which I'm not criticising. They just were what they were. So it was a much favoured way of, because people thought, well, I could make a lot more money.
And as a lawyer in this time, was it a case of just saying, looking around and thinking, some of this makes me uneasy, but the economy's going well? And
I think it depends what you were doing at the time. And I think, it was a good time also for, I think if you were doing transaction business, you were just focused on, you were so busy, probably.
Yeah.
That you didn't really look up at what was happening. You wondered sometimes about how can they be borrowing all this money or whatever. But you didn't sort of know if it was causing a disaster.
That's interesting.
And the guys doing the securitization, I don't know if they really had an idea that this was all going to go belly up. I don't know. I never did that stuff. So I'm not guilty of the crash, okay?
Sure. But
I think people were just getting on with it and riding, an awful expression, riding the wave of activity.
But that's an interesting point, though, about at the time, people are just going out about their day-to-day business. They're busy. And perhaps it's only when you look back on things is when you start to see these patterns forming.
Hindsight is wonderful.
It is.
But I think, in the law firm, there was... Is it worth just talking about that there's more change now in law firms going on? Because by the end of this period, as I've said, I think they were transformed from what they were before. We talked about, for example, this was a period where, in terms of the way they structured themselves, sector expertise became a big thing. And this is how people were saying, so we understand the client's business because we have these sector expertise. This became quite a new thing.
So that was as opposed to kind of focusing on the lawyer's practice area. They were flipping it around and looking at the client's
sector. Understand. We're all in the energy sector. We've got this big team doing nothing but this. Because there was the idea you really needed to understand your client's business more. And then pricing of business was a big thing. It wasn't now just an hourly rate times bodies out and so on. It was you had discounts because people were negotiating against you, and success fees came in, what they call value billing. But still most general counsels and clients, they, however you talk to them, they still came back to ours because they understood it. And it may be different now. And actually, there's another thing came in, a live auction, for example. We're talking about beauty parades, but this is where, I remember doing several of these, where a company wanted to sell a business, let's say. And so who should be my lawyers? And they knew six law firms, let's say. Said, well, we'll have a live auction. And what you had to do was you submitted some paperwork. And then the clock started ticking, say, for an hour. When it started, you bid your price to do the work.
Right.
So was it £1 million, £1.5 million, £2 million? And you'd start at the beginning and you'd put in a price. And then you'd see, you wouldn't know who it was, but putting in other prices.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get a feel for what's going on. And then it would stop. And then the end would come. It was the end of the hour. And you'd look. And then it would all go mad. People were bidding to see if they could get the work.
So they're dropping their price.
Yeah.
Then? Yeah, so you started high and you went lower.
Well, or you started low and decided, well, I'm going to stay there. You had a strategy which you had no idea. And And we did several of these. It's absolutely potty way of appointing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Potty way of appointing a law firm. But quite an extraordinary experience.
Okay.
Yeah. So all of this was changing. And
I suppose all of this really unthinkable in the early 80s, if you go back to that time.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, there was now a price for commoditized work. There was a price, you know, it was £5,000 for this agreement or whatever it might be. Very different. And, and more of that performance assessment, more of that learning stuff was...
So the kind of fixed fee rates and more commoditized work versus everything by the hour.
Well, and the commoditized work was which, as you know, I mentioned the model, which is hours of times, leveraged associates, you had four associates to one partner, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Well, now what, again, was happening was the more commoditized work, like, if you'd say, due diligence in an M&A deal, could be hived out to India. And half, a third, a tenth of the price. A lot of support stuff went out to these places. So
that was the beginning of legal process outsourcing,
definitely.
Became a big thing post-2008.
Post-2000, yeah.
Yeah.
This is all growing.
Yeah.
Okay. People were experimenting. It was quite interesting, actually.
So, but then, just before we wrap up, there was a few other kind of key wider developments in this time. So you kind of had the... talked about the IRA bombs in the 80s, but you had kind of return of terrorism in with the the London bombings in 2005, Mumbai train bombings.
Yes, yeah. And some in other countries
and other countries as well. Yeah. And at the time you also had the Gulf War and Afghan wars.
Yeah, which raged. Well, unfortunately, they weren't. Were they in terms of? They didn't last as such as massive wars, but they were wars of attrition in a way, weren't they? That went on and went on. But frankly, they just sat there in the background. I think people got used to the fact there was just a war going on.
Just
terrifying thing is that might happen with Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just people focusing on the day to day and getting used to
it. Well, certainly in this group, because it was so busy that you didn't have time to.
But obviously it's all, you know, we're going to do 2008 in another episode because there's so much there of that and such a dramatic crash.
Yeah.
But there were, you know, signs that things were going wrong in 2007 with Northern Rock. And yeah, as I said, we're not going to go into detail of that, but it is really quite, this kind of dramatic end to this period. The other thing I wanted to touch on was technology. So, you started the period in 1993. You still didn't have a computer on your desk. We talked about in the 80s there was no computers on your desk, but still at the beginning of this time.
Probably not. They were coming in then. Yeah. I should think by the mid-90s, certainly where I was, I think we probably had screens on the desks. But there wasn't, of course, the level of sophistication of usage of internet and something at this point.
But then... at the end of the period in 2007, the first iPhone has been released. And before that, of course, you had the BlackBerry, which was a big thing for city
this
lawyers.
The early 2000s were the era of the BlackBerry, which did change work because it meant you could work on the move.
And that was like, just for listeners who don't know what that is, that was like a kind of a phone, but you could send emails from it.
Yeah, a phone, email. It was the first, in a way, it's like a digital... wasn't it? It was first phone, I suppose, not an iPhone technically.
Yeah,
not that I really understand what technically an iPhone is, but the BlackBerry was a marvellous thing, and everybody. And then suddenly, I think it lasted till about 2011. Peaked in about 2011. Around then, next few years, it just petered out. But it was a wonderful. Everybody had a BlackBerry in the city in 2000. Before that, I had a pager. I used to use a pager.
Yeah, I remember pagers.
Which was a great thing too. Cause you could at least know when somebody needed to get hold of you. Availability being a very important... But actually, I'll tell you, I was a very well-known lawyer at another major firm in London, and I thought he said, when he asked, what do you think the key qualities of he was a corporate finance partner, very good. And he used to say, well, you need the three A's. You need ability, availability, and affability, and that's it. And I think there's another one that you should add to that, which is adaptability and agility, because that's how the big law firm, all the law firms that have really succeeded, changed and innovated and created stuff. Yeah. And there are some people who didn't accept that you had to change. They thought they could go on in the old model. And that was just a mistake.
It didn't work.
No. And that's why the makeup of the ecosystem of law firms in London has changed so much, because some didn't adapt.
Such an important point. And just the final point on that was the kind of beginnings of email.
Yes.
That's an area which so different for law firms. And I suppose the growth of the BlackBerry was all about email in some ways.
Yeah.
And that was something, again, at the start of the period, I guess, how many emails were you sending a day in the early 90s?
Yeah, there's nothing really. By the 2000s, it was just uncontrollable. The amount coming in.
So it's been a really interesting walk through that period, Alan. We're out of time, but I think we've covered 93 to 2008 very, very comprehensively. And of course, next episode is all about the big crash, 2008, which we've touched on this episode. So thank you very much, Alan, for joining me.
Well, it's been really interesting to think about it and to actually do it. And I think if I was to think, well, from a law firms, the ones that are making are doing what would do well now, is that we talked about money and everything else. The ones that do the best, I think, are the ones who think about growing the cake instead of how you divide it.
Okay.
And that's the difference between, I think, the very best ones and the...
Does that involve investment?
It involves always growing rather than how do I take what my partner's got.
Okay.
Yeah.
So looking ahead to the next thing.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, we'll be back for the next episode, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.